I wish I could think it possible, but I don't.
It mightn't even give them a joke. It might be just a question of drawing back to jump further next time.
But then the question is that if we don't have a settlement of that kind after Korea, what do we have?
Well, I think we ought to look at this from one point, and that is, I think, personally, that the Soviets have made it think they've succeeded in their limited tactical aggression in Korea, if you look at it from the point of view of the whole world front, in doing the one thing they didn't want to do, and that is to set the whole Western world to rearming and to building up their strength. The question in my mind is, can you stop rearming and remobilization at a certain given point and come to an agreement with the Russians, or does it lead inevitably to further rearming on both sides and then in catastrophe?
That's what comes with monkeying with a buzzsaw.
Well, there, you see, the question is rather of Russian aims and whether they've miscarried. But if we take that point that Wells has just raised, another question arises, which is, supposing the Russian aims have miscarried, then those slant our aims that we take advantage of it. Alexander, do you see any point there by which we could improve the position which is not only our own position, but the position of the whole world?
Yes, I think an Australian, both officially, I think, and unofficially, would say here that when we have met the immediate objective in Korea, we'll need to set up some machinery which in that section of the world will give us a better guarantee than existing machinery for dealing with a future act of aggression in that Pacific region. In other words, what I'm referring to is the suggestion frequently made by Australians of different political parties that something like a Pacific Pact is needed to supplement the North Atlantic Pact.
Fletcher? I think if and when we have the military success in Korea that we hope and foresee, you will have an extraordinary opportunity in the Far East, because the loss of face to the Russians is going to be enormous. They will have lost the tactical and the strategical advantage that they got originally, and at the same time, the fact that they have woken up the hornet's nest, from their point of view, of a rearmament and a getting together of everybody, of the United States and of Western Europe, must impress, in my view, having lived for a long time in China, the thinking Chinese with the fact that they have made a strategical error, and I agree with Wells here, of the very first order.
Well, I really can't go so far as that with Wells and Fletcher, I must say. I think it's true that military victory in Korea would lead to a certain loss of face by Soviet Russia. But they're not, after all, directly engaged. That is the great strength of their position. There are military advisors of theirs in North Korea, but there are no Russian troops. Their puppets alone fight their enemies. By a sort of remote control, they get their enemies attacked by their own stooges. And that seems to me a great position of strength. And it means that if things do go wrong with any of their adventures, well, they can back out without a great deal of loss of faith. And what's more, they can profit, and this I'm sure is important, the fact that they're not on the ground in North Korea like the Americans are, means they can exploit the latent hostility of all Asian peoples to foreigners, just as foreigners. And that, I think, gives them a very powerful position in the Far East.
Don't you think that applies to the Russians, too?
No, because they're not on the ground. You see that they're not on the ground in North Korea. It's one of these remote control wars, and I hope we've seen the last of them. But it is important to realize they're not on the ground, and they get an advantage there.
Well, I think that's a very nice speculative discussion, if I may say so, between Fletcher and Mayhew as to what effect this is all having on opinion in the Far East.
Very important.
Very important, no doubt, but highly speculative. At the risk of being accused of riding an Australian hobby horse, I'd like to hear what you think about specific proposals for strengthening the machinery in this region, not as inconsistent to something larger, but as one thing that, as an Australian, I would suggest, has been proved by the Korean incident as being lacking and very necessary.
Well, now, Mayhew.
Well, as a long-term aim, I'd agree with Alexander. We want a Pacific Pact. But at the present time, I think it's academic and premature to talk about it. The truth is, it doesn't seem that the Indians want one, or the Indonesians either. And the truth is that a Pacific Pact at this time would be, to all intents and purposes, a white man's pact. Now that, I think, would be a source of weakness rather than a source of strength to the cause of democracy in the Pacific. It must be altogether not only the Western countries, the European countries, but also the threatened countries of Asia, India in particular. And until we get that situation, I'm for going a bit slow on this Pacific Pact stuff.
Well, I think that brings up some very interesting angles. If we have to put off the development of a Pacific Pact with effective forces until certain of the Asiatic nations, who perhaps have only gained their freedom very recently, are ready to come into such a pact, we may find that those powers soon pass under the domination of the Soviet Union. I'm not so sure that Professor Alexander isn't on the right track. I think the Pacific Pact has been born, and I think it's been born in Korea. And I cannot see, with the formation of a British Commonwealth division, with the sending of various European and other forces to Korea to fight with the Americans, I cannot see that we shall disband this grand alliance for many, many years to come.
Director, I think you had something to say about that.
I don't think that Mayhew has yet purged himself of the virus of hesitancy from the Foreign Office. I think that the Pacific Pact is there, I quite agree with Wells about that, because there is hesitation due to lack of understanding, and because there isn't very much strength to back it with in certain Asiatic peoples, there is no sort of reason for not starting it now and getting on with it and forming it. It will take a long time to form, and it will need a good deal of education. But unless you start it now, with Australia probably in the lead, you'll never start.
Alexander, this is a matter dear to your heart.
Yes, I don't want to join an anti-Mayhew coalition or anything like that. But I suggest to Mayhew that the Asiatic countries like India will tend to be much less suspicious of a white man's pact in the Pacific than they would be of some return to what they might regard as a white man's empire in the Pacific. And so that this question of the Pacific Pact relates to my first contribution, the request that we tried to get clear in our minds as to how far we are in Korea today to support international machinery, or to what extent we are really using that as a means to another end, which we feel is the only one that will give us security.
Well, now that we've broadened it to this extent and started considering the whole eastern area, I don't think we can overlook the extraordinarily important question of the recognition of China. I wonder, Mayhew, whether you would like to start the ball rolling on that question as to how this is linked with the Korean problem.
Well, I think it underlies a great deal of the Korean problem. Indeed, I think that the rather different approach of the United Kingdom on the one hand and the United States on the other to the Chinese Communist government is at the bottom of a number of our embarrassments in the Far East today. I'm thinking in particular of Formosa. Here we have a most difficult problem. The United States declaration that the 7th Fleet would protect Formosa and also stop the Formosa-based blockade of communist China, I think it's understandable from the United States' point of view. Undoubtedly, it lessens the likelihood of a communist Chinese attack on Formosa, and thus removes a possible threat to United States, United Nations security in the Pacific, and their operations in Korea. And it's at least arguable that the Chinese communists have no right to Formosa anyway. But the United States has not recognized the Chinese government, but for us. Of course, their declaration does present a desperately difficult position. Our attitude to the Chinese communists is that they're rather less of a satellite, I think, than the United States seems to think. I don't know what Wells will say to that. But that being so, it's much less easy to justify resistance to the Chinese government occupying what can at least be argued to be their own territory.
That's right. Well, first of all, I don't think it is their own territory. It was agreed originally that it should only become their own territory after the Japanese peace had been signed. Now, recognition is a two-way thing. If you nod to somebody, you at least expect him to nod back to you. We have been heavily nodded since the time that Mayhew was the Foreign Office of the China. They've never nodded back to us. They've taken on none of the obligations of the previous government, and they refuse to recognize them. And I think that it's about time we were realistic about this and not legalistic. I think that we've got to say quite clearly that as far as Formosa is concerned, we've got a good legal smokescreen for our action. But unless we make it perfectly clear that we are marching with the United States on this particular question, we shall be doing creating the possibility of a breach which may upset the whole peace of the world.
As the American President, Wells, I think you should say a word here.
Well, I think the unhappy fact of the matter is that the United States is still in what we might call friendly relations with the nationalist government of China, which is on Formosa. And I think that we have done one good thing by ordering the Seventh Fleet to neutralize Formosa for the time being. We have made no final commitments as to what will happen to Formosa. But even though the Chinese Communists may not like what we've done, at least it will keep them quiet. It will not involve Communist China in the possibility of a very serious conflagration with the United States, perhaps leading to war. We don't need any more enemies in Asia than we have at the moment. By letting the Communists take Formosa, we might get involved in war with Chinese Communists. By neutralizing Formosa, at least we keep them out of the possibility of war.
Major.
Well, Wells seems to assume that there won't be a Chinese attack on Formosa. I hope that's so. But what worries us, of course, is the possibility that there may be. And what then should the United Kingdom do? Fletcher says, we stand by the Americans. Well, to my mind, it must depend to some extent on how the attack arises. If the attack on Formosa is coupled with the Chinese communist assistance to the North Koreans, for example, or in Indochina, or with an attack on Hong Kong, or if it takes place with Soviet-Russian assistance, then I'm sure our duty is clear. We can't stand aside and let the United States fight a battle which belongs to all of us, which is part and parcel of the defense of freedom everywhere. But if the attack is limited, on the other hand, and isolated, if it's just an operation by the Chinese government alone, then assuming the United States asks for our help, then I think we're at least entitled to weigh up the issues very carefully. It's such a terribly difficult decision for us. Two basic principles of our foreign policy are in conflict. On the one hand, Anglo-American solidarity. On the other, solidarity with India and other genuine nationalist movements in Asia. In my view, it's a terribly difficult problem, and I hope we don't have to decide it now. I don't see why we must.
The fact that it's difficult shouldn't mean that it's put into a pigeonhole and not decided.
Well, that, I think, is all we have got time for now. It's been a discussion which has ranged over a very large part of the world, as I must say I expected it to, because Korea is, after all, nothing more than a symptom of a world problem. I did say at the outset that I thought that the speakers would come to it with divergent approaches. And in that respect, at any rate, what I said has proved correct. I should add that they were speaking entirely unofficially, every one of them. Notwithstanding their respective nationalities, they were not speaking for their nations, but they could not perhaps help adopting a national point of view in everything that they said. And although that has given a very great deal of varied color to the discussion, at the same time, I don't feel that in this brief summing up, I need produce any minority reports, so to speak, because although various views were put forward as to how we should do it, nobody ever diverged for one moment from the original proposition as to what it was we should do, and that was that on this Korean question we must make it finally clear to the whole world that aggression will not be allowed to succeed again. And so this London Forum, so diverse in its speakers and yet so united in that overriding conclusion, it does in a way mirror the unity of purpose that now animates the whole English-speaking world.
That was London Forum, a transcribed program. This is the British Broadcasting Corporation.